This is a Kim Monson news briefing.
The signature that staked a fortune. John Hancock wrote his name first and largest on the declaration, and we remember the gesture as a dare flung at a king. The parchment records something heavier, one of the largest fortunes in the colonies, the most seizable kind of wealth there was, pledged by the one man the crown had already come after. Behind glass in the National Archives in Washington, at the head of a sheet of parchment 2.5 centuries old and nearly rubbed clean of its ink, one name still carries across the room. It is written larger than any other on the sheet, set by itself beneath the last line of the text and above the crowded columns of smaller signatures that follow, in a bold upright hand with heavy downstrokes and a long looping paragraph ruled beneath it like a line drawn under a sum. The words above it have faded to a whisper of iron and gall. 2.5 centuries of light have all but erased. We hold these truths to be self-evident. The name has not faded. John Hancock. It is the most famous autograph in the country, so famous that the name came loose from the man and hardened into a common noun. To sign a thing is to put your John Hancock on it, and a child who has never read a line of the Declaration of Independence knows the phrase and knows it means the big, confident signature at the bottom of the page. The engrossed parchment measures about 24.25 inches by 29.75, and it has been on public display in Washington since 1952, where a visitor can lean toward the case on a summer morning and find that the signature reads more clearly than the sentences it was signed beneath. The object is still. It has been still for a very long time. What moves is everything the name gathered up behind it. Everyone knows the gesture, and almost everyone knows the wrong story about it. The signature comes down to us wrapped in a piece of theater. Hancock strides to the table, writes his name broad enough that King George can read it without his spectacles, and dares the crown to come and get him. It is a wonderful scene, and it is a 19th century invention, printed for the first time 65 years after the fact. What the parchment actually records is heavier and less comfortable than a quip. It records a merchant setting one of the most exposed private fortunes in America at the head of a document that royal power would read as a confession of treason, and doing it after royal power had already come for his property once and very nearly ruined him for it. The signature is a receipt for a stake. Every signer pledged the same closing words, but for the man whose name sits first and biggest, those words were the least abstract in the room. The hand at the ledger. Go back 11 years, to the same hand before it was famous. In John Singleton Copley's portrait of 1765, a young Boston merchant sits at a covered table in a dark blue coat trimmed with gold, an open account ledger before him, and a quill poised in his fingers, and the ledger is dated to the year of the sitting. He is doing his books. Copley, the finest painter in the colonies, has caught a man of 28 in the ordinary act that made him what he was, counting money on paper, and the picture is a plain document of the thing Hancock would later pledge, the same hand, 11 years early, adding of a fortune it would one day set at the head of a treason. The fortune was not his by making but by inheritance, and it was enormous. His uncle Thomas Hancock had built the House of Hancock into one of the great mercantile concerns of New England, in good part on profitable contracts supplying British forces through King George's War and the French and Indian War. And when Thomas died in the summer of 1764, the business, the mansion on Beacon Hill, and thousands of acres of land passed to the nephew he had raised, who became at a stroke one of the wealthiest men in the colonies. John Adams, who would later stand as his lawyer, put it dryly, "The aunt was the relic of an uncle who had left the greatest part of his fortune to him. He was rich the way few Americans were rich, and he was rich in a particular and dangerous way. A merchant's fortune is the most seizable kind of wealth there is. A farmer's wealth is land, and land stays in the ground. A planter's fields cannot be loaded onto a warship and sailed away. Hancock's wealth was ships, and ships can be seized at the wharf. It was warehouses, and warehouses can be padlocked. It was cargo and credit and paper that is only ever as good as the trade that stands behind it. His whole estate floated on water. The Royal Navy controlled and passed through a customs house the Crown ran. A man who holds that kind of fortune and then signs his name to a rebellion is not risking an abstraction. He is offering the king the most collectible kind of collateral a signer could bring to the table, and he knew it, because the king's officers had already tried to collect once. The sloop at the wharf. On the 10th of June, 1768, a boat crew from the warship Romney rowed to a Boston wharf, cut Hancock's sloop Liberty from her moorings, and towed her out under the guns of the man of war. The waterfront answered at once. A crowd that estimates put near 3,000 gathered as the sloop was hauled off. Customs officers were roughed up and chased through the streets. A customs official's pleasure boat was dragged up to the common and burned in front of the town. The affair helped bring two regiments of British regulars to occupy Boston that autumn, and it made Hancock, already the richest Whig in the town, the most conspicuous target of the Crown's revenue men in America. For his defense in the Vice Admiralty Court, he retained a rising young lawyer and cousin of his fiercest political ally, John Adams. Whether Hancock was in fact a smuggler is a question historians have argued for a century, and it is worth staging honestly, because the honest version is sharper than either legend. The Customs Board's own paperwork, in the reading of the Adams paper's editors, seized the Liberty, not for smuggling, but for failing to obtain a permit for a cargo it had loaded, a technicality on a ship riding light. A month before the seizure, a tidesman who had inspected her found nothing wrong, then reversed himself once the Romney was in the harbor and swore that casks of Madeira had been run ashore in the night while he was held below, that recantation is the whole of the smuggling case, and it is the crux of the dispute. Oliver Dickerson read the record and called Hancock a near victim of British revenue racketeers who profited from the seizures they engineered. John W. Tyler, whose study of Boston's merchants found smuggling in the port to be a violation of law but nothing out of the ordinary, would go no further on the man himself than to note that Hancock's guilt or innocence and the exact charges against him are still fiercely debated. William Fowler, whose 1980 life remains the standard scholarly account, wrote that the board targeted Hancock, Boston's wealthiest Whig, and may have suspected that he was a smuggler, or they may have wanted to harass him because of his politics. Fowler's own verdict was that Hancock probably ran some goods past the duties, that most of his business was legitimate, and that his later fame as king of the colonial smugglers is myth. The narrow point is the one that matters here, and it is not in dispute. Whether or not a duty went unpaid on a pipe of wine, the Crown had marked John Hancock, singled out his property, and set out to break him through it. The prosecution ground on for months. The penalty suits against him swelled to £9,000 before the government, unable to make the case, quietly let it drop, the clerk noting on the docket in the spring of 1769 that "our sovereign lord the king will prosecute no further hereon." He kept his fortune that time. What he did not keep was any illusion about what royal authority could do to a merchant it wanted to ruin, because it had spent a year trying to do exactly that. When he signed the declaration 8 years later, he signed as a man who had already stood in the king's own court and watched the crown reach for everything he owned. The name in print, the name on the skin, the wealth had a shape you could see from the harbor. Hancock's mansion stood in cut granite on the slope of Beacon Hill above the common, the plainest possible statement that the man inside it had more to lose than almost anyone in the colony, and it stood there in full view of every delegate, every customs officer, and every British general who passed through Boston until it was pulled down in 1863. That was the estate on the table in the summer of 1776, when the Second Continental Congress, with Hancock in the president's chair as its presiding officer, moved from resistance to a formal and irrevocable break. And here the record insists on a precision the legend erases, because Hancock's name went on to the declaration not once but twice, in two different hands, on two different days. The first time it was set in type. On July 4, 1776, Congress adopted the text and sent it that night to the printer John Dunlap, who ran off the broadside sheets that carry the news out by rider and packet across the 13 states. That printed declaration bore only two names, John Hancock as President of Congress and Charles Thompson attesting as its secretary, and no other. The famous columns of signatures were still 4 weeks off. The printed version, Hancock's name in coal type at its foot, was the one read aloud in the towns and carried across the Atlantic to be laid before the king and his ministers. When Britain first saw the declaration, it saw Hancock's name printed, not written. 2 days later, on July 6, Hancock signed a letter in his own hand directing General Washington to have the declaration proclaimed at the head of the army, and on July 9 it was read to the assembled brigades in New York, the reading that sent a crowd down Broadway that night to pull down the King statue. The presiding officer's signature was already at work, moving the words out to the soldiers who would have to make them true. The second time, it was written. On July 19, Congress ordered the adopted text, engrossed, copied out by hand in a fair formal script on a single skin of parchment, and retitled, The Unanimous Declaration of the 13 United States of America. A clerk named Timothy Matt Lack bent to the lettering. Only on August 2, 1776, in the flat words of the Journals of the Continental Congress, was the Declaration of Independence being engrossed and compared at the table, at last signed. That is the day the great autograph was made. It was made for the delegates in the room and for the generations who would come after them, and it would not be shown to the public with the signers' names attached until the Goddard broadside of January 1777, half a year later. The popular memory compresses all of this into one glorious 4th of July, a single afternoon of quills and courage. The parchment corrects the memory. The name we treasure was written on the 2nd of August into a document that most of the world had already read in print. The most seizable wealth in America. Set the size of the signature against the size of the risk, and the flourish stops looking like vanity. 56 men eventually put their names to the engrossed declaration, and every one of them subscribed the same closing sentence, pledging to each other their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor. For most of the signers, the word fortunes meant land, standing, a farm or a practice or a seat, the kind of wealth that stays where it is put and cannot easily be carried off by an enemy who holds the sea. For the man whose name sits alone at the top, bold and centered above all the rest, fortunes meant ships that a navy could sink, warehouses a garrison could seize, and paper credit that a blockade could turn to nothing. He pledged the most liquid, the most exposed, the most collectible kind of wealth in America, and he wrote his name first and larger than anyone's above the whole company of men who pledged with him. That is the true and sufficient story, and it is worth guarding against the fond one that has grown up over it. The affectionate tradition, given fresh voice in Willard Stern Randall's 2025 biography subtitled First to Sign, First to Invest, wants a ledger to go with the signature, Hancock buying the cannon that broke the siege of Boston, outfitting the privateers that harried British shipping, paying to rebuild the town the war had wrecked. It is a stirring account, and the documentary record does not keep that ledger. The guns that came down from Ticonderoga were Henry Knox's expedition on George Washington's orders and Washington's warrant of £1,000, not Hancock's money. The privateer commissions that carry Hancock's signature were acts of the office he held, the President of Congress signing what Congress authorized, not the investments of a private shipowner. The post-war giving was philanthropy, and the reviewer in the Journal of the American Revolution warns that Randall's telling of it verges on the hagiographical, reading a rich man's well-considered generosity as simple open-handedness. The tradition reaches for a hero who spent his fortune like ammunition. It overstates, and the overstatement is a favor the real man does not need. What the record keeps is plainer and harder. It keeps a president who found it necessary, Fowler notes, to hire his clerks at his own expense. It keeps a fortune that, in the standard biographer's flat phrase, had suffered greatly because of the war. It keeps the fact that Boston's wealthiest Whig, the man with the most to lose and the most that could be carried off, put his name at the head of the list anyway and paid for it in the coin of a merchant, which is the slow bleeding of an estate that can no longer trade in safety. Alfred Young, writing on how the founding was remembered, caught the discomfort the fact still produces. The genteel America that came after was not comfortable with a rich man who pledged his fortune to the cause of revolution. He did not need to spend the fortune down to a shilling to have staked it. The stake was the signature. The bill came due for years. This is why the reason Hancock signed first matters, and why the legend gets even that small thing backward. He signed first because he was the president of Congress, and the presiding officer signs first. It was procedure, the plain courtesy of the chair, not a lunge for glory. John Trumbull's great canvas, painted more than 40 years later and hung in the Capitol Rotunda, gives us the scene the way a young republic wished to remember it. The delegates gathered in dignified order, Hancock seated at the front to receive the document. It is a beautiful painting and an honest fiction, a composite of men who were never all in that room on any single day, made long after the fact by an artist who was not there. The parchment behind the glass in Washington is the harder evidence. On it, the procedure and the stake meet in one stroke of the pen. The presiding officer signs first, and the presiding officer that summer happened to be the man who had put the most on the table. Hancock lived 17 more years after the 2nd of August, governed Massachusetts, and died in 1793 with his estate thinned and his health broken. The young merchant of the Copley portrait grown into an ailing statesman his own countrymen were already half embarrassed to have needed. The mansion came down in 1863. The House of Hancock is a footnote. The sloop Liberty was sold off by the Crown and never came back to him. What outlasted the fortune was the fortune's receipt. The name that became the word for his signature is still there behind the glass in Washington, written first and largest and bolder than the ink of the sentences above it, the deliberate hand of the one man the Crown had already tried to ruin, set down at the head of a document the whole world had already read in print, a bill a free people can walk up and read for itself on any morning it chooses, and a stake that 2.5 centuries later is still, in the plainest sense, open in our names. And now, Kim's perspective. Liberty has a price, and a free people pays it out of its own substance. The signers pledged 3 concrete and losable things to one another, their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor. John Hancock, holding one of the largest and most exposed fortunes in America, wrote his name first and largest, and then watched that fortune bear the long cost of the war. The word fortunes in that sentence was a line item, a real thing that real men stood to lose, and a self-governing republic still runs on what free people are willing to put into it, rather than on what a government hands down to them. Reading the document, funding the cause out of our own pockets, and holding our elected representatives to the plain words of the text is the standing work of keeping that pledge real. The receipt is still legible in Washington, and it is still, in the sense the founders meant most literally, made out in our names. For the full article with sources and links, visit kimmonson.com. This has been a Kim Monson News Briefing.